While the Appalachian Mountains stretch from parts of Canada to Alabama, the cultural regions of Appalachia typically refers only to the central and southern portions ranging from the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia southwesterly to the Great Smoky Mountains, and is called home by approximately 25 million people. Since its recognition as a distinctive region in the late 19th century, Appalachia has been a source of enduring myths and distortions regarding the isolation, temperament, and behavior of its inhabitants. Early 20th century writers often engaged in yellow journalism, or fake news, focused on sensationalistic aspects of the region's culture, such as moonshining and clan feuding, and often portrayed the region's inhabitants as uneducated, violent, and other derogatory stereotypes.
Let's all square dance!
Promenade across the floor, sashay right on out the door and into the glade, and everybody promenade!
Well, they certainly can dance, and this is called clogging, by the way. But where did the Appalachian people come from, and how did their culture come about?
It was in the 1730s that the ancestors of today's Appalachians began streaming into the mountains. To escape hard times, they came from Germany, England, and Wales. But the group that would become most prominent in the mountains started their journey off the rugged coast of Northern Ireland.
They were a grim, stern people, strong and simple, swayed by gusts of stormy passion. The love of freedom rooted in their heart's core. They were of all men best fitted to conquer the wilderness and hold it against all comers. Teddy Roosevelt.
A bit of Irish history accounts for the Exodus. 100 years earlier, King James of England had grown tired of battling rebellious Scots in the lowlands. The king thought he could use the Scots as a hedge against the bothersome Irish, so he offered them free farmsteads in Ulster, in the north of Ireland.
What better thing to do than to get some of the borderland Scots, who were always giving you trouble, to go over and whoop up on the Irish?
So they took advantage of it, moved to Ulster, got farms, and they became known as Scotch-Irish.
For about 100 years, the Scotch merged with the Irish. They mixed their words, they mixed their phrases, they mixed their horse racing love. They took, in many ways, the best qualities of both people.
After a century in Ulster, the Scotch-Irish were suffering religious persecution, rising rents, and bad harvests. Tens of thousands moved on to a second migration to the New World. This hybrid culture took root in the southern mountain wilderness of Appalachia.
The Scots-Irish were very quick to be among the first settlers who actually made their permanent home in the mountains. Those mountains that had the funny smoky look in the morning.
When we were got up to the top of the mountain and sat down very weary, we saw very high mountains lying to the north and south as far as we could discern. It was a pleasing, though dreadful sight, to see mountains and hills as if piled one upon the other. Robert Falham, 1671.
Once they'd made their permanent home in the mountains, they by no means were the only ones that settled in there, but they were the most colorful, most influential.
You had the other mix of the Germans who came here. And the Germans are known for their orderliness and, you know, their rules for everything and building really staunch barns out of material that will last.
The Scotch-Irish, on the other hand, tended to be more footloose and fancy-free. And the Scotch-Irish also were more hot-tempered than the Germans. And so when the Indians attacked, you wanted Scotch-Irish there because they were terrific fighters. But when the Indians weren't there, the Germans were just as happy not to have the Scotch-Irish around.
It was said at the time that whereas the English, when they got to America, would build a church, the Germans would build a barn, but the Scotch-Irish would build a whiskey still.
Whiskey making was only one of the skills that the frontier migrants brought from the Old World. With traditional crafts like quilting, pottery, and metalwork, they furnished their homes and cooked their meals as they always had. But the tradition closest to their hearts was music.
Music was especially important. It gave them comfort. It was something that they could do themselves. They could sing, they could play their fiddles and have a dance. Invite the neighbors over.
The most important instrument the Scotch-Irish brought with them was the fiddle. Small, portable, and plaintive. The old fiddle tunes were greatly beloved and passed along through the generations. The same rugged mountains that held and nurtured music and culture also marked the western boundary of colonial America. These settlers who had come from the borderlands of England were living again on the edge of two worlds. But the rich land beyond the hills was bound to call to the adventurous pioneer.
There was a time when going way out west meant going out to Cane Tuck, the dark and bloody ground, as the Indians called.
In 1769, a backcountry explorer forged his way across the Alleghenies. After traveling dark wilderness trails for 5 weeks, he and his men came upon a most remarkable sight.
I had gained the summit of a commanding ridge. Looking round with astonishing delight, beheld the ample plains, the beauteous tracts below. Daniel Boone.
Boone could see that the territory was ripe for farming. And 6 years later, he established a settlement in Kentucky. He was flatly defying British orders to stay east of the Alleghenies and avoid the French, who held lands to the west. Throughout the 18th century, English, French, settlers, and Indians were mired in combat in Appalachia. It was said a man could live from boyhood to old age and never know a time of peace. The culminating battle began when the colonies declared their independence in 1776. The American Revolution was hard fought in the mountains by all the friends and foes of the colonial cause.
We have to remember that the Revolution was a civil war. There were people on both sides. By and large, the people who were on the side of the crown or who were neutral or indifferent in Appalachia did not take up arms. One of the assumptions of the British Army that invaded the South in the 1780s was that if they reached the backcountry, that the loyalists there would rise up, and that didn't happen.
Most of the mountaineers, especially the Scotch-Irish, were fiercely committed to throwing over British rule. They were among the first to sign up when George Washington sent out the call for troops.
The Scotch-Irish had declared that these colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent. And it was from these that came that outburst of rugged and determined people that made the Declaration of 1776 possible. Colonel A.K. McClure, newspaper editor.
The most famous backcountry fighters were the Overmountain Men of Tennessee, who defeated the stalwart Colonel Ferguson at the Battle of Kings Mountain in South Carolina. Ferguson had threatened to cross the Appalachians and exterminate the people if they didn't support the king. In his proclamation, he called the mountaineers white barbarians. To the colonel's surprise, the barbarians charged his forces, seeking cover behind rocks and chasing the soldiers up the mountain, tree by tree. They killed nearly 200 British troops, including Colonel Ferguson.
Well, they won. They won because they adopted the Indian style of warfare, as they had before. And they won because the loyalists in the backwoods didn't rise up in support of the British Army.
The surprise victory snuffed out British hopes for taking the South and was a critical turning point in making America the land of the free. George Washington said if he ever had to make a last stand, he would want to stand with the Overmountain boys who knew how to shoot and fight. The Revolution was a turning point for Appalachia. The region headed into a period of significant growth and change. Thousands of soldiers were rewarded with free homesteads, bringing a flood of new settlers to the mountains. And the proud mountaineer would soon find himself doing battle with the very government he had just helped bring to power. The Scotsman had always known how to make liquor from barley and rye. They quickly learned to use Indian crops instead. Wheat and corn, berries and potatoes, just about anything that grew. Selling whiskey was good business, much more profitable than selling any of the bulky raw crops. But George Washington's government was buried in debt, and one of the ways they tried to pay it off was with a tax on whiskey.
The settlers of the Western country were so opposed to this tax because it was very reminiscent of the taxes that were imposed on the colonists under the rule of King George of England. The people that were on the frontier were the rugged individualists, they're the veterans of the American Revolution that fought to establish this country.
They were very jealous of their property and their rights. They valued freedom. They did not want to be told what to do by anyone.
A string of violent protests broke out from New York to Georgia. It became known as the Whiskey Rebellion, and it raged from 1791 to 1794. The new tax was not to be tolerated.
It was a tax that was required to be paid in cash. And cash was scarce on the frontier. Whiskey was a commodity that was used as money. Ministers were known to even accept payment for their Sunday services with whiskey. It would be not uncommon when a federal tax collector would come here, that they would tar and feather him. One violent outbreak in the Western Carolina region, they actually took the excise tax collector and ground his nose off at a grinding wheel.
This was a fight the settlers could not win. Washington took 13,000 troops into western Pennsylvania under his personal command. It was an army as big as the one that had fought the Revolution. The rebellious moonshiners were crushed. Rules and regulations were bound to be imposed on these people who wanted to believe they could just be left alone. The Appalachian mountaineer could grow or make everything he needed to survive. He had learned to rely on himself and did not want outsiders dictating how he was to think or behave in politics or in religion. For a few generations, worship was held inside the family or in the most humble mountain chapel. The religion most had carried with them was Calvinistic, tough, dark, and demanding.
The old intellectual Calvinism started giving way to this new thought that God is all-loving, God would like to save us all we have to do is repent and ask for forgiveness, and we can be saved. That's the doctrine of free will, that we have it upon ourselves to decide whether or not to be saved. Well, this is more optimistic. People could get happy with religion.
By the 1740s, this more hopeful vision was spreading like burning tinder through the mountains. There began a long series of evangelical or enthusiastic religious revivals, known as the Great Awakenings, that would last more than 80 years. Ministers of every stripe swarmed into Appalachia, bound to bring the unchurched into the fold.
Most of these people had never before seen a minister or heard the Lord's Prayer, service, or sermon in their days. After service, they went to reveling, drinking, singing, dancing, and whoring. And most of the company were drunk before I quitted the spot. Charles Woodmason, minister, 1768.
Presbyterians did not have enough educated ministers to reach the far-flung population. The Baptists and Methodists were more successful because they commissioned farmer preachers and sent them off into the mountains. They were called the circuit riders. They spoke a common language with the people they were trying to convert and inspired them to gather together for worship. By 1800, the revival had found its most powerful outlet. Settlers left the hills by the thousands, on foot, on horseback, in the family wagon. They traveled long days to the great camp meetings under the mountain sky.
My name is Robert Sepper. Today's Clog Dancing is by Paul Shelnut. Please leave a comment, please share, and don't forget to subscribe. Until next time.